Good morning. This morning I'd like to focus on the story of Jesus calming the storm on the Sea of Galilee that Nathan read for us here. This is a story that appears in all three of the synoptic gospels, and that's not at all surprising to me, as it must have made a big impression. Certainly it was dramatic. In Matthew, it set out at chapter 8 and verses 23 through 27. In Mark, it set out in chapter 4, verses 35 through 41, and in Luke, it's at chapter 8, verses 22 through 25. And just in case there's any confusion, this is a different story than when Jesus walked on the surface of the Sea of Galilee. That's a different occasion. But anyway, in Mark's version, Jesus was teaching the crowd near the Sea of Galilee, and Mark records several parables that Jesus taught that day: the parable of the sower, the parable of the lamp on a stand, the parable of the growing seed, the parable of the mustard seed. But these were apparently just a sampling of the parables that Jesus taught that day. For in verse 33, Mark records as follows: "With many similar parables, Jesus spoke the word to them as much as they could understand. He did not say anything to them without using a parable. But when he was alone with his own disciples, he explained everything." And as evening came on, Jesus told his disciples, "Let us go to the other side of the lake." So leaving the crowd, Jesus and a number of his disciples loaded up onto a boat. And I can certainly understand how Jesus, after a long day dealing with the crowds, would want to get away. It reminds me of the old Southwest Airlines commercial, you know, want to get away. Anyway, Jesus did want to get away, to find some relative solitude away from the crowds. And so, in fact, that was kind of the pattern we see with Jesus, where he would often retire at night to pray in seclusion. This is a boat discovered in the Sea of Galilee in 1986. It's been dubbed the Jesus boat. No one's contending that Jesus was ever in this specific boat, but it does date back to roughly the right time period, and it seems to be roughly the right size. It's about 27 feet long and 7.5 feet wide, and it could probably accommodate about 15 people. Reconstructed, it might look something like this. Anyway, this is typical of the type of boat that was in use on the lake at the time that Jesus walked the earth. And while they're out on the lake on a boat that probably looks something like that, a furious squall came up, and the waves washed over the gunwales and threatened to swamp the boat. But Jesus was asleep. Apparently, it had truly been a hard day at the office, and the waves and the violent rocking of the boat had not been enough to wake him. Instead, the disciples had to wake him. And when they did wake him, they expressed fear that they were all going to drown. In Mark's version, it says, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" In Matthew, it was, "Lord, save us, we're going to drown." And in Luke, we have, "Master, master, we're going to drown." Now, a number of Jesus' disciples were fishermen with long experience on that specific lake. I don't believe that they were exaggerating the situation. They were clearly terrified. But Jesus got up and rebuked the wind. You know, it's kind of a non sequitur here. I sometimes think of the children's book, you know, by Maurice Sendak, "Where the Wild Things Are," you know, where the monsters are gnashing their terrible teeth and roaring their terrible roar, and Max in his little white suit stands up and says, "Be still." Well, okay. Nothing similar here, except that Jesus gets in the front of the boat and he rebukes the winds and the waves and he says, "Quiet, be still." The wind dies down and it is completely calm. And after Jesus calmed the storm, he turned to his disciples. And in Luke, he said, "Where is your faith?" Matthew is perhaps a little harsher: "You of little faith, why are you so afraid?" And we get Mark: "Why are you so afraid? Do you still not have faith?" Anyway, the disciples were terrified. First, they were terrified by the storm, and this is kind of an understandable physical fear. But now they were terrified because of what they had just watched Jesus do. And they asked each other, "Who is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him." This is a short little vignette from Jesus' ministry. It takes up only 7 short verses in Mark, 5 in Matthew, and just 4 in Luke. But there's a lot packed into this story, and it has always been very meaningful to me. And so I would like to spend some time this morning exploring some of the themes from this story. First, I want to talk about recharging of batteries. You know, Genesis tells the story of God's creation of the world, And the idea is that he accomplished the work of creation in 6 days, but then on the seventh day, he rested. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. And from Genesis 2, verses 2 and 3, "And on the seventh day, God ended his work, which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all the work which he had done. Then God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested from all the work which God had created and made." Now, I'm not here this morning to discuss whether the days of creation in Genesis were literal 24-hour days or merely descriptive periods representing the phases of creation, but I do believe that there is wisdom in the pattern demonstrated by God here. Period of toil, and then a purposeful rest, and that period of rest being a period of blessing and sanctification. I believe we're called on to be productive, and that we should not emphasize the concept of rest to such an extent that it renders us lazy and useless. But I also believe that we can be most productive when we purposefully plan for and intersperse reasonable periods of rest. That's healthy for the body, for the mind, and certainly it can result in higher quality work. I believe that there is great wisdom in this. But what you should note about the time of rest here in Genesis 2 is that it was a time of blessedness and sanctification. When God delivered the Ten Commandments to Moses, this godly wisdom of a period of work and then a period of rest was reinforced. The fourth commandment is remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. Again, a period of rest, and again, the special rest period is set aside to be holy. During his ministry, Jesus was constantly surrounded by the crowds. He taught the crowds. He had to tussle with the Pharisees and the teachers of the law who opposed him and sought ways to trap him. His apostles were often disappointing and frustrating. The crowds and his own apostles kept pushing him to go to Jerusalem, throw out the Romans, and declare himself king. People who needed healing were always coming up to him. He healed a good number, but there were so many. It must have been exhausting. And so Jesus would make a practice of withdrawing from the crowds to recharge his batteries and to pray. Here in Mark chapter 6, "Then because so many people were coming and going that they did not even have a chance to eat, he said to them, 'Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest.'" Luke, we have, "However, the report went around concerning him all the more, and the great multitudes came together to hear and to be healed by him of their infirmities. So he himself often withdrew into the wilderness and prayed." This story is of Jesus calming the storm is yet another example. The crowds were pressing around Jesus, and he was weary. And so to escape the crowds for just a time, Jesus got on the boat and pressed out across the lake. Now, with Jesus coming in the new covenant, I don't believe we're under the old covenant anymore, and I don't believe we're strictly bound by the command to keep the Sabbath day holy. But still, I believe we should heed this biblical wisdom. We should attempt to order our lives so as to set aside what we now call the Lord's Day, to make it a special time for rest, but also for holiness and for family. Now I want to talk about whether or not any of us can really blame the apostles here. Okay, Jesus was with them, and yet they were terrified. And this brings a rebuke from Jesus. Where is your faith? But can any of us really blame them? You know, when I was a younger man, I would often be exaggerated by the Israelites in the desert during the wilderness wanderings. These were people who had seen God act with awesome and unmistakable power. They had experienced the 10 plagues that God had inflicted on the Egyptians. They had seen God part the Red Sea. They had walked across the Red Sea between columns of water. Then they had watched as the Egyptian army trying to copy their feat, but only to have God release the waters and drown them. They saw the light show on the mountain as God delivered the Ten Commandments to Moses, and yet they were down in the valley below making a golden calf. God was literally throwing bread and quail at them to sustain them in the wilderness. They were being led by a pillar of cloud by the day and a pillar of fire by night. And yet, the story of the Israelites in the wilderness is a constant drumbeat of grumbling, doubts, and even rebellion. Amazingly, in their grumbling, they even wished to go back to Egypt where they had been slaves. Just to hit a few highlights, Moses is away from them for less than a month, and they build a golden calf to worship. A man named Korah would lead a rebellion that God had to put down. The ground literally opened up and swallowed them. Even Aaron and Miriam, Moses' brother and sister, spoke out against Moses to such an extent that God struck them down with leprosy. He would later relent. But anyways, I've grown older, though, maybe a little wiser. I started to view the Israelites in the desert with a bit more charity. For instance, in Numbers 20, the people had reached the desert of Zin. There was no water. The people were gathered together in opposition to Moses and Aaron. Verse 3, we see, why did you bring the Lord's community into this desert that we and our livestock should die here? Why did you bring us out of Egypt into this terrible place? It has no grain or figs or grapevines or pomegranates, and there is no water to drink. You know, in some ways, I see the Israelites in the desert of Zin and the apostles on the boat in similar positions. Yes, the Israelites in the desert should have been keenly aware that God was with them. And while I don't mean to compare Moses to Jesus, Moses was undoubtedly God's man, and Moses was with them. People should have had faith that God would protect them in all extremity. In the same way, the apostles in the boat should have been keenly aware that God was with them, that Jesus was with them there in the boat, and they should have had faith that God would protect them in all extremity. But can we really blame either group? For the people in the desert, it's hot. They're in a desert. They have no water, no immediate prospects for obtaining water. You know, I'm not certain that there is a greater human drive than the need for water. Can I really blame, you know, grumbling parents when their children are crying to them, "I'm thirsty"? Can I look at them and say, "Oh, ye of little faith"? Frankly, I cannot cast any stones at the Israelites for crying out for water in the heat of the desert. I probably would have been right there with them. And for the apostles in the boat, they're about to drown. I mean, the fear of drowning is a primal fear. And being on a small boat, being tossed around, that is about to founder, that would be terrifying. Okay, Jesus was with them. That should have been some great comfort to them. But was Jesus really being fair when he asked them, "Where's your faith?" I probably would have been right there with the apostles, screaming, "We're about to drown." But in both instances, the people were miraculously saved. In the desert of Zin, God told Moses to strike the rock with a staff and water gushed forth. In the boat, Jesus calmed the storm. But in the end, I would draw a distinction between the physical and the spiritual. In the physical world, we are human. We have frail bodies, bodies that can be hurt, bodies that can be killed. We Christians are not exempt from the frailties of the body. We will all die someday. We will all know pain, though perhaps in greater or lesser amounts. God causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. I do not believe that because I am a Christian, God will never allow bad things to happen to me in this world. I do pray for comfort, for freedom from pain, even for safety. And I believe that God hears those prayers, and he may choose to protect me from such dangers to some extent. But in the end, what I pray for most is that God will fortify me with courage to face what comes, fortitude to bear up under life's vicissitudes, confidence that I am loved, knowledge that I will not be tested beyond my capacity, and assurance that beyond this veil of wrath and tears, I will be comforted and I will have a place in God's heavenly home. At any rate, as humans, we cling to our physical life, and I believe that we should do so. And I understand those who experience fear when that physical life is threatened with harm or death. We also have a spiritual side. We have a soul. And that soul is nourished by the Holy Spirit while we're here on this earth. Physical death is not the end for us. Our names are written in the book of life. When we do shuffle off this mortal coil, we will have a place in an eternal heavenly paradise. As Christians, we should at least be able to take comfort in the idea that whatever happens to our physical bodies, it cannot threaten our spiritual natures. That is our ultimate protection from God. Jesus was physically with the apostles in the boat. Metaphysically, Jesus is always with us. So if we are ever not in a small boat being tossed around in danger of foundering, we may indeed drown. And the fear of the loss of our physical bodies is a normal reaction. For that reason, I have a hard time blaming the apostles for being frightened. But such fear should not completely unman us, because even if we do drown, we are not eternally lost. Trust in God, even in such dire straits, and your soul is safe. Next, I want to talk about what I like to think of as a pantheon of miracles. Sometimes I wonder at the many miracles in the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. Some of them seem to catch our attention, and we talk about them a lot more. Others do not. We don't really talk about them, and they just kind of fade into the background some. But they shouldn't. And I've created what I've called my own pantheon of miracles, where I look at a miracle, and I just want to say, wow, that's a big one there. And I want to talk about a few examples today. Let's go to Joshua 10. In the book of Joshua, the people had crossed into the promised land and they were waging military campaigns to establish themselves in the new land. The people had made a treaty with the city of Gibeon, and five kings had banded together to attack Gibeon, and Gibeon appealed to the Israelites for help, and Joshua force-marched the entire army to the scene to support their allies. God had assured Joshua that he would give the enemy host into Joshua's hands, and indeed, the Israelites routed them and they fled. But as they were fleeing, God hurled hailstones from the sky at the retreating army such that more died from the hailstones than had died in battle. But the enemy host was large, and the Israelites needed more time to destroy it. So Joshua prayed for the sun to stand still in the sky to give the Israelites more daylight to complete the slaughter. Then we read in verses 13 and 14, the sun stopped in the middle of the day and delayed going down for about a full day. There has never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to a human being. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. You know, this is not a miracle that we seem to remember that much. We don't talk about it much, but wow, what an amazing miracle. Now, I don't know what happened here. I mean, did God actually stop the spinning of the earth around the sun, or stop the earth from its trek around the sun? Or did, you know, he just simulate the light of the sun in the sky for a period of time? I don't know. But this miracle rates pretty high in my pantheon of miracles. It's up there. Now I want to talk about the destruction of the Assyrian army. The Assyrians were brutal and powerful, the most ferocious empire to date. And they are truly nasty people. They had already carried away the Israel, the northern kingdom. Judah remained, but Jerusalem was under siege by a massive army. Sennacherib, the Assyrian king, was mocking the Jews and their God from outside the walls. But Hezekiah, the king of Judah, prayed to God for deliverance, and his prayer was answered. God acted with unbelievable power. That night, the angel of the Lord went out and put to death 185,000 in the Assyrian camp. When the people got up the next morning, they were all the dead bodies. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, broke camp and withdrew. He returned to Nineveh and stayed there. Again, just a paragraph in the Bible. Back in 2 Kings, we don't study it all that much. We don't talk about this miracle all that much, but wow! God snapped his fingers and killed 185,000 soldiers. You know, what a scene that must have been. I doubt there were 185,000 people even inside the city. What do you do with 185,000 corpses lying around the city? How do you dispose of them before pestilence sets in? What kind of grisly bonfires would have been necessary? I appreciate, there's a poem by Lord Byron, George Gordon, Lord Byron, that I've always appreciated called The Destruction of Sennacherib. I like the poem for the beauty of his language, but I really appreciate it because Byron read this same passage in the Bible and had the same reaction I had. Wow! Just for some flavor, this is the first stanza of the poem as it describes the Assyrian army as it descends on the city. The Assyrian came down like a wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold, and the sheen of their spears was like stars on the sea when the blue wave rolls nightly on deep Galilee. The last stanza describes the end of the army and emphasizes the unfathomable power of God. And the widows of Asher are loud in their wail, and the idols are broke in the temple of Baal, and the might of the Gentile, unsmote by the sword, hath melted like snow in the glance of the Lord. Again, this is a miracle we don't talk about much, but we should. And it rates pretty high in my personal pantheon of miracles. And that brings me to Jesus calming the storm. By this time, the apostles had seen Jesus perform many miracles. But by and large, these miracles have been relatively limited in scale. Healing individual people, casting out demons from individual people, You know, perhaps feeding the 5,000 was on a grander scale, but it still seemed to be Jesus manipulating what was directly in front of them, you know, what was coming out of the basket. Commanding the winds and the waves to stop howling just seems to be on a completely different scale. This was Jesus controlling the elemental forces of nature. This was much grander and more impressive than anything the apostles had seen before. The apostles were clearly aware of that fact when they asked, "Who is this? Even the winds and the waves obey him." I agree with the apostles. Wow, what a miracle. This is indeed high on my pantheon of miracles. I serve an amazing God indeed. But the real reason that this story is special to me is that it has a very personal meaning for me. We rightfully associate Jesus with peace. In Isaiah, we're told, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace." We think of Jesus as Prince of Peace. That's in Romans, we're told, "Therefore, since we have been justified through faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ." I'm not going to read the rest of that, but we associate Jesus with peace. But that does not necessarily mean that Jesus would, at least in the short term, bring peace among men. In fact, Jesus stated as follows, "Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace on earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword." These two are not mutually exclusive. Jesus and his ministry would bring a convulsion that would, in the short term, result in struggle and dislocation, the absence of peace between men. But what Jesus did afford his followers was peace of mind. When I read the story of Jesus calming the storm, I generally think of it in metaphysical terms. The storm on the Sea of Galilee becomes, in my mind, a storm in my own mind. Oftentimes, my mind seems a turmoil. It is a cauldron of fears and worries and insecurities. It makes it difficult to concentrate, difficult to sleep. It can affect my health. It can affect how I deal with those around me. It can lead me into sin. What I need is peace of mind. I need calm. I need assurance. I need stillness. I need certainty. When my mind is racing in this way, I think of Jesus calming the storm on the Sea of Galilee. I say to myself, "Peace be still. Peace be still." I think of Jesus calming the physical storm on the sea, and I picture him calming the spiritual storm in my mind. I think of the waves and the winds calming, and it helps me to calm the storm in my head. It helps me gain peace of mind. When I concentrate on Jesus and his great power, I come to understand that whatever I'm facing at the moment is merely trivial and fleeting. Whatever is going to be will be. Que sera, sera. It will not change the basic truth that I am loved by God, that my place in heaven is secure, that I will not be tested beyond what I can bear, that this too shall pass, and God will grant me peace. Sometimes I let the old hymn, "Master, the Tempest is Raging," run through my mind as a means to still my mind. I love that old hymn. It is faithful to the text, captures the drama of the situation, and its lyrics are wonderfully poetic. The lyrics kind of set the scene, and the music builds the tension. It builds to a crescendo, and there's a great release of that tension and a return to calm. It's a classic hymn. Set out in our songbooks at page 189, and I would like to lead that song to us now. Probably do better if Stanley got up here and led it, but I'm going to give it a try. But anyway, I do this because I want you to remember this dramatic story from the Bible. And just reading the story, or even hearing a lesson about it, those are not all the ways we can engage our mind and our memory. Anyway, there's another way, perhaps a better way, is to sing about it, to put words to music. Oftentimes we can remember tunes and lyrics much better than we remember just prose. And sometimes, more than anything we just read, music reaches our imagination and our emotions in a way that simply reading or discussing does not. So turn with me to page 189 in your hymnals and join me in song. Since I've been putting you to sleep for the last 20, 25 minutes, let's go ahead and stand so that I can pretend that I'm keeping people awake in some way.
Master, the tempest is raging, the billows are tossing high, the sky's overshadowed with blackness, no shelter, no help is nigh. Carest thou not that we perish, how canst thou lie asleep, when each moment so madly is threatening, a grave in the angry deep? O winds and the waves shall obey thy will, peace be still. Whether the wrath of the storm-tossed sea, or demons or men or whatever it be, no water can swallow the ship where lie the master of ocean and earth and sky. They all shall sweetly obey thy will, peace be still, peace be still. They all shall sweetly obey thy will, peace, peace be still. Master, with anguish of spirit, I bow in my grief today. The depths of my sad heart are troubled. Awaken and save, I pray. Torrents of sin and of anguish sweep o'er my sinking soul. And I perish, dear Master. Oh, hasten and take control. The winds and the waves shall obey thy will. Peace be still. Whether the wrath of the storm-tossed sea, or demons, or men, or whatever it be, no water can swallow the ship where lies the master of ocean and earth and skies. They all shall sweetly obey thy will. Peace be still, peace be still. They all shall sweetly obey thy will. Peace, peace be still. Master, the terror is over, the elements sweetly rest. Her sun in the calm lake is mirrored, and heaven's within my breast. Linger, O blessed Redeemer, leave me alone no more, and with joy I shall make the blessed harbor, and rest on the blissful shore. O winds and the waves shall obey thy will, peace be still. Peace be still. Whether the wrath of the storm-tossed sea, or demons or men or whatever it be, no water can swallow the ship where lies the master of ocean and earth and sky. They all shall sweetly obey thy will. Peace be still. Peace be still. They all shall sweetly obey thy will. Peace, peace, be still.
Please be seated. So as you leave here today, you go through your normal routines, always keep this story close at hand. As Jesus did, practice the art of maximizing your efforts while you labor. Intersperse that with periods of rest, or those periods are set aside for holiness. Understand that we are human with frail bodies subject to pain and death. Fear and apprehension are natural reactions. We should not be ashamed of them, but we should not let that shake our bedrock understanding that we are loved by God, that whatever happens to us in this life, in the grander scheme of things, is trivial and fleeting. We may suffer, we may die, but we cannot be separated from God, and ultimately, we have a place in heaven. Marvel at the great power of the God that we serve. His power is so great, he controls even the primal forces of nature. He controls the winds. He controls the waves. God's hand is not too short. If we place our trust in him, we will not be disappointed. And lean on God for your peace of mind. In this veil of wrath and tears, we will be subject to many fears and troubles. Worry just seems to be our natural state. You may worry about your health, your finances, your job, your spouse, your children. As an elder, I worry a lot about our little church and the spiritual health of all who call it home. If your mind is not a roiling cauldron, then I submit to you that you have not lived long enough, you are being overly protected by others, or you are simple. But God can still the turmoil in your mind. When your mind is troubled, remember this story from the Bible. Say to yourself again and again, peace, peace, be still. Peace, peace, be still. Maybe even sing the song, Master, the Tempest is Raging. Let it run through your mind, and hopefully, like it does for me, This will help bring you peace. Just remember the phrase, peace, peace, be still. In fact, let's practice that now. Let's say it all together. Say it with me, peace, peace, be still. May God bless the preaching of his word. If any of you have a need that we can serve this morning, need for prayer, need for any other problem that we can address, if you want to put on Jesus in baptism, we stand ready to assist. And let's all stand as Stanley leads us in song.